Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Eric Tuohy, and he'll be answering your most important questions on musky magic. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Eric a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to the website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Eric Tuohy about musky magic. Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in to support such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Eric, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com. Look for the link under Eric's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. And click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We will also be giving away a $25 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. They're a premier fly shop in Boulder, Colorado, offering both local guide services as well as international guide services. So here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. And the first person that submits the correct answer wins that $25 gift certificate. Tonight, our guest is Eric Tuohy, and Eric was introduced into fly fishing and tying at the young age of 15 at a fishing show in Minnesota where he grew up. Since that day, Eric has had a fly rod in his hand and a vise at his desk. After attending college in Bemidji, Minnesota, his love for musky fly fishing brought him to Hayward, Wisconsin. Currently residing in Hayward, the musky capital of the world, he has started his guiding and photography business, Catch and Capture, targeting musky, pike, and bass on the local area lakes. Not only enjoying the art of fly fishing and fly tying, Eric is always looking for the next photograph, just like looking for the next big bite. Well, Eric, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hey, how's it going, Roger?
Good, good. Were you out fishing today?
You know what? Unfortunately, was not out today. We've had an unusual winter. We ended up getting dumped on with snow, and it's definitely getting a little crazy out there. We got a couple inches already accumulated. Nothing like you might get out west, but the upper Midwest, spring.
Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
I guess I'm sitting here in Colorado, and it's almost spring-like.
Yeah.
Snow's almost gone, and people are skiing
yeah.
in their T-shirts and stuff, so I'm getting a little spoiled out here, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely wild year, so.
Yeah. Well, got lots of questions to go through tonight, talk about musky, and let me just check on
Perfect.
Things here. Make sure we're all working. All right. Okay, good. And so let's just start out. Now, you said you're in the musky capital of the world, huh? That's
so they claim. Yeah. So they claim this area has a lot of old history. So all the way back into the early logging days, and kind of with that being said, it's kind of taken on its that term or the being the capital. And we also have the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame right here in our back door, and so it's definitely a mecca of a little bit of everything here. So
right now, our muskie, we know about muskie in Wisconsin, and
sure.
I guess that's the central place, like you say, but we also hear about a lot of good muskie fishing up in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Are muskie available in other parts of the world other than North America that you know about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the upper, Midwest in general is, they're native to a lot of the waters in this region of the upper Midwest. But, they do stretch as far south as Tennessee, the Carolinas, even as far as out west to where you guys are. There's some great stocking programs that, are implemented in some of the reservoirs in, the mountain range area, and as far south as the Nevada, New Mexico area and stuff like that. So there's a lot of opportunities that are out there and available to most anglers if you just take a little time to do your research.
Mm-hmm. But what about Europe or Russia?
Well, as you start to get over there, they're more predominantly pike, as we know, like in the European continent. So definitely unique to the North American region for sure.
Okay. And what is muskie part of the pike family, or pike part of the muskie family? Are they related?
They're actually related. So they're actually part of the esox, as the scientific term is. But so the pike is also – there's also the walleye, as anyone who fishes in Minnesota or Wisconsin. Many of anglers seek out the walleye for, a good dinner meal, especially and. Angling opportunities. So they're all part of the esox family.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep.
Okay. And then what about, now I know we have them out here in Colorado, tiger muskie. So what are tiger muskie?
Yeah, so the tiger muskie are really unique. Basically what you have is that a northern pike and a muskie have actually crossbred. So this does happen naturally in the wild. We get that in our waters. And definitely where you might find pike prevalent. Now, as you mentioned out there, the DNR are able to produce this hybrid fish, tiger muskie, and they're able to put those into, reservoirs or possibly rivers and streams as they choose or see fit for the fisheries. And they're unique, though, that they are actually infertile, so they cannot reproduce. So safe catch and release in releasing these fish are extremely vital to having an apex predator fishery in your area.
Mm-hmm. Why would we use tiger muskie, like, say, here in Colorado, rather than try to introduce, the authentic muskie?
It's easier, adaptable. They have a quicker growth rate. Especially when you do have good food resources available to them. So their growth rate is definitely a huge perk. And also the success rate. So your success rate is, from what they've done with the studies and everything on raising muskie, we have even a different strain of muskie than Minnesota even, and they've tried to implement some of the Leech Lake clear strain, muskie into our waters, and that can be sometimes detrimental to where that they actually don't have a very good success rate. And sometimes that could be disease, sometimes that could be other factors too as well that come into place, but definitely high success rates with that hybrid tiger muskie for stocking purposes.
Now, in Wisconsin or Minnesota, Canada, just north of you,
mm-hmm.
Did they do any stocking with muskie, or is it all, are they all wild?
No, there's definitely stocking that does happen. In Wisconsin and, for the most part, Minnesota as well, you can look up, they actually classify our musky waters, very similar to how they might classify a trout stream. So they'll actually classify, at least in Wisconsin, class A1, A2, class B, and class C. So that is, you know, the class A1 is, you know, very large fish, not very big numbers, and then A2 would be that maybe there was some stocking, but very little. It's mostly actually natural, and then still good numbers, but also big fish that are also available. Trophy fishery, basically, as that would say. And then class B is that, you know, yes, there's been some stocking going on at some point in time in the history here, but it's actually also a thriving ecosystem as well. And then class C might be intensive, you know, intensive stocking and trying to keep up a population up there. So there are some stocking that does go on depending on the body of water.
Do they have different than fishing regulations in those types of fisheries that you just described?
Like, yeah, so
release or not? Or?
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's definitely a catch and release sport. So this fish is, it takes a long time for this fish to get big, and they are the apex freshwater predator out there. So with that being said, you know, safe handling, everything is super key, but state to state, it may vary, you know, where they have a minimum length. So for a long time, you know, part of Wisconsin was actually a minimum length of, you know, as low as 32 inches in some areas. And now they're finally starting to up that, you know, with support, you know, backed by Muskie Zinc and some of these other, you know, sporting groups to be able to up that, you know, in the 40s, or even better yet, trying to create a trophy fishery in the, you know, 50 or 55 plus inches to be able to harvest the fish.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, when I've been, I've never caught a muskie and a fly. I've caught pike. And it seems like pike, it seems like you catch pike at all different sizes. But it
sure
seems like all the pictures of muskie are always, they're always large.
It does seem like.
do you end up catching, you know, like they call, you know, the small pike hammers and stuff like that when they're thin and skinny. Do you end up catching the smaller muskie, or are they hidden out somewhere? Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, the, you know, jack or pickerel or, you know, hammer handles like you're saying. Yeah, I mean, they're definitely, you know, when you're in, especially if you're fishing in areas that are a natural ecosystem and thriving, you know, you're going to find small fish and you're going to have small fish that eat. And sometimes depending on the water, you might really only find a lot predominantly smaller fish just because how that ecosystem plays out. But yeah, there's definitely smaller fish or average cookie cutter sized fish. Everyone though obviously is looking for, you know, the big giant, the beast, you know, the one that, you know, is going to make, there'll be a fish of a lifetime, you know, and that 50 plus inch mark is where a lot of anglers really trying to put their time into and, you know, breaking that point.
Yeah. Now, what is, you know, what do you consider an average tiger? I mean, average muskie, not tiger muskie. An average muskie, and what do you, what constitutes a trophy fish?
Yeah. So, yeah, that's a good question. It is a little bit dependent on body of water. So, I mean, there are some bodies of water where, you know, the, you might average more fish in that upper 30s, maybe lower 40s, with potential of smaller and bigger fish. So that can be a little bit dependent on the area. And being, like I mentioned, you know, where you have fish that are various sizes across the board, especially in an ecosystem, you know, that average can fluctuate. Sometimes it's higher, sometimes it's lower, especially if you're fishing in, say, a trophy fishery or maybe a, you know, a class C type lake where there's predominantly smaller fish. As you, I guess, well, there was a second part of that question. Can you repeat that again?
Yeah, I was just, you know, what's a trophy size and what's an average size?
Oh, sure. I mean, trophy size is going to be really what, you know, is going to make the angler, you know, see that as a trophy. You know, a trophy, I think, in anyone, I think in general, is catching a muskie. A muskie is a fish of 10,000 casts, as they say. And so you're really working a lot, and you're working extremely hard, sometimes in tough conditions. And so any size can really be your trophy. It might be a 35-inch pike, or excuse me, a 35-inch muskie. It could be a 48-inch muskie. I think personally, as you start to break over that 40-inch mark and you start getting up into your mid to upper 40s, you know, you're really starting to get into a whole different subclass of fish. You're talking a lot of power, a lot of teeth. They're eating big meals. And then as you start breaking into your upper 40s and 50s, you're getting serious super tankers. I mean, that's a very big fish, and definitely, yeah.
Yeah, the, I'm just looking at, I know in Canada they have something like I know for pike, like when they hit 40 inches, then it's some kind of certified trophy or something like that. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, a little bit familiar with that.
Is there anything like that in the U.S. For muskie, where at a certain point they're considered, you know, trophy material?
I guess, you know, there's not anything that's out there that I'm familiar with, and, you know, I could be mistaken that, but, you know, like a trophy certification, but there's a lot of great, you know, support, you know, like Muskies Inc. is one of the biggest well-known, and they actually take some, if you're a part and you're a member of Muskies Inc., it's very similar to what Trout Unlimited is, just for, you know, the muskellunge, and so basically, you can submit, you know, your catches per year, and guys will submit these every year, and they'll post a board basically with, you know, largest fish, and they actually do have a fly rod subcategory within that as well. So that would be definitely a great avenue as something unique, though, to be able to showcase your catch and have it be noticed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. We did get a kind of a follow-up question on the stocking programs. Barry,
sure.
Grace Lake, Illinois, says, I've never heard of muskie stocking in either Wisconsin or Minnesota. How common is that?
Yes, I mean, that's a good question. It is something that's prevalent, and it is dependent on the body of water. If the DNR do see fit to have these fish in there, or if they even had them naturally and, say, they got fished out or there was a winter kill or there's some other, you know, things that could play a role in that. But there's definitely stocking that happens within the Midwest, no doubt.
So it sounds like it's more selective for, you know, as the need arises, as opposed to, you know, like the way trout are stocked in some areas where every year they dump loads in, you know, because,
yeah,
you know, people come and fish out the stockers, you know, every year, basically.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a little bit.
Yep, different. Definitely very much handpicked in a sense. You know, the DNR, they're going to be out in some of these bodies of water, and they might do electroshocking. They might set up pike nets where, you know, they can have this fish, you know, be taken and, you know, tagged, and then they get an idea of maybe what's in this body of water, and they're able to make a judgment call from there. So, yeah, definitely a little bit more hand-selected versus an area.
Okay. Let's take a quick break here, Eric, and then we'll come right back.
Okay.
And we'll talk about muskie magic.
So. Awesome.
Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Eric Tuohy about muskie magic. If you'd like to ask Eric a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Eric, I always ask my guests at this point in the show, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world, so tell us a little bit about your business and, you know, if there's anything else we need to know about you and the fly fishing world, you know, tell us about it. So.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Catch and Capture is my business up here that I'm operating. So specializing in the lakes, area lakes in the Hayward, Wisconsin area, and muskie is kind of, you know, my primary niche as we were talking about tonight, but, you know, I do also, you know, provide service with bass and northern pike, and whether that be largemouth or the smallmouth bass, both are a great fishery up here. So with that, I've been doing some shows, so I've been got a chance to get out to the Colorado area, and I've been also taking over a little bit of as much as I can in the upper Midwest here and just promoting and getting the good word out there and taking some bookings for this upcoming year and the following. So,
yeah, now I know you, you know, we saw each other in Denver. And you were,
yeah.
You were doing some tying there. So is that, are you doing a lot of tying demos, or are you also doing other presentations on muskie?
Yeah. Yeah, so part of, I mean, definitely part of, you know, this, the muskie fishing is tying, and, you know, for a very long time it's been, you know, we really couldn't go into a fly shop and go and buy it and hand pick, you know, a couple muskie flies that were sitting in a shelf or on the wall. We had to make these things, so it's truly a unique kind of art form to the sport of it, but doing a lot of tying, I enjoy it. I think basically everything in my box is hand tied by me, and you know, it's just, it's part of the sport. It's awesome, and I think people seeing that and getting to show them that, it definitely is an eye grabber, no doubt.
Do you have a website for catch and capture?
Yep. So you can look me up at catchandcapture.com. Bit of information on some of my guiding rates. And, you know, I also do offer something unique to my clients, is that I'll, you know, during their adventure, photographing their day and putting that into, you know, a really unique album that they're going to be able to take home or have at home with them or in their office, that is in secondary, you know, as an option for that angler. It's a nice little way to be able to show off to your friends and, you know, have a little bit of a bragging book. But they can get in contact me through the website. Definitely look me up through some of the social media outlets, you know, Facebook, and also out there on the Instagram as well. So, you know, I look forward to hearing from some folks as well.
Okay, good. I'm going to talk about that a little later when we come back to that. Fish of 10,000 casts.
Absolutely.
I've just got to be curious about the guiding situation there. So we'll come
back.
Oh,
my gosh. Yeah.
Let's. We did have one more question. Roy Fukushima in Orange, California asks, he says, I live in Southern California and will be making a trek to Minnesota to fish Lake Minnetonka in surrounding areas. When is the best time of year to fish, and what gear set up in flies while I need to catch muskie, he says, pike, smallies, and walleye. So
okay.
That kind of leads us into two things, time of year up in Minnesota and Wisconsin for muskie, and then we'll move on and talk about equipment. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, I do have to say Roy is very fortunate. Lake Minnetonka was actually right in the area that I grew up, so that lake, I've got some, you know, it's old stomping ground, so to say, for me at least. So Lake Minnetonka is a unique body of water, extremely kind of large and vast in the sense of, you know, multiple bays that interconnect and twine. You know, in my opinion, with that lake, is that getting out there once you get some of your weed beds established. And, you know, it's unfortunate that they have such a heavy milfoil. It's an invasive weed bed that grows out there, but the fish do seem to attract to it, and they use that as structure. So, you know, once those weed beds start getting, you know, established end of June, maybe early July, and then, you know, once you break out of the dog days, because also that lake is a recreational lake, as that, you know, you're going to have a lot of, you know, jet skiers and other, you know, larger boats that are also enjoying, you know, that, the beautiful water up there. Late fall or mid-fall can be outstanding, so you get a little bit less people on the lake. But that's a unique time of the year where these fish are, you know, they're gravitating towards, you know, feeding, because our season, you know, we have ice eventually, so they have to be able to prepare their body weight for the spring, so then when they spawn and they lay eggs and they do their natural thing, you know, they got to get ready. So that's a big feeding time for them. You know, some of the gear, I would say, you know, with some of the gear, you know, you've got such a large range, and we could probably touch base a little bit more on the muskie and pike gear-wise. That's going to be a little bit larger.
Let's just stick with that for now, because we've
smallies and walleyes, though. You know, smallies and walleyes, 6 weights, you know, 7 weights, you know, 8 weight as a top, you know, maximum rod, as a weight rod to be able to go with on those things. So, but yeah, we'll touch base on the muskie pike stuff gear-wise and fly bit more.
Yeah, let's, you know, like what weight rod and line do you normally mend for muskies?
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, muskies, you know, a 10-weight kind of is just the benchmark across the board. You know, it does allow for the angler to be able to throw. There's such a variety of lines out there now on the market. And, you know, I think starting out an intermediate, a full intermediate line is an outstanding line. It gives that angler, you know, a lot of forgiveness in their cast because, you know, you're going up to a 10-weight rod. There's a lot of meat there, and then you're throwing a fairly large fly. So lots of forgiveness in something like that. They can handle casting, you know, right off the bat typically if you got, let's say, a little bit of gear conditions. And, you know, but we can go down as low as a 9-weight, and we'll go as high as sometimes 12 weights, 11 weights, you know, as we start upsizing our flies. So basically as you upsize your flies, upsize your rods, make it easier on yourself. But 10-weight across the board, no doubt. And you can use that for pike as well, you know, especially when you're talking about close, you know, trophy classification type pike, 10-weight would definitely do justice as well.
Now, I suppose, you know, when you're out after big muskie or pike, you've got to be ready for the big one. You don't want to be undergunned.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely.
Miss that trophy fish. So, now you said intermediate sinking line. Is that your standard line that you set up with regularly rather than a floating line?
Yeah, so kind of with that, you know, intermediate line, you know, we're predominantly fishing subsurface flies, so streamer patterns, so to say, flies that we want to be able to fish a little bit deeper in the water column. So, and since our flies and our benchmark flies are actually very neutrally buoyant because we utilize a lot of bucktail, some other materials that are naturally buoyant. So when we use intermediate line, that's actually pulling the fly down, and it's actually going to give that fly a swimming action that's like no other. And that's what we need to achieve in our flies. That's what why we'll use these lines, like intermediate lines, to be able to swim that fly. We will definitely fish sinking lines, you know, 350 grains, 400 grains, 500 grains. I mean, all those things are tools that we utilize to be able to, say, fish a fly a little bit deeper. Or if we have a big deer hair head on the front of that fly, that's a lot of, you know, buoyancy in that fly. We need to be able to fish that down in the column effectively. We still use a floating line, though. So our floating lines, you know, are going to be primarily if we have, say, a little bit of, you know, big, you know, aluminum or lead dumbbell eyes on that fly, and say if we want to be able to fish that over a weed bed so we can, you know, use the floating line as an anchor slightly to keep it higher in the column, but then letting that fly pop twitch over weed beds. We're also going to fish topwater flies, so poppers are definitely a big part of the topwater game for musky fly fishing. So it can be a lot of fun, and, you know, if it's available, to take advantage of it as well.
Okay, and what about your terminal tackle? How do you set up your leader and stock tippet, and what's your standard setup there?
Sure. So basically off the reel, you know, I use a large arbor reel just in the sense that, you know, we need to be able to hold a line and a line capacity to that reel. Up from that, you know, through your rod, we're going to start off with our leader material. I personally, and this is not end-all, be-all by any means, you know, I run about a 3.5 foot leader overall in length, and that's going to consist of 40-pound fluorocarbon. I like and enjoy using Seaguar fluorocarbon, blue label stuff. It's good, strong stuff. It's going to last a while too, and that's going to then go into. I like to use a loop-to-loop connection to 40-pound wire. And this 40-pound wire, you want something that's coated. Rio makes a great product in their bite wire material. There's additional companies such as American Fishing Wire, Toothy Critter, et cetera. So, but 40-pound fluorocarbon to a 40-pound bite guard in a wire that's coated, that wire should be tieable. And off that end of that wire, instead of tying directly to our fly, I'm going to use something like a Mossad Sherlock. These are just very specific how snaps, so clevises that are used that are high in tensile strength. They're not going to come undone, and you're not going to lose your fly. If you, say, had a large fish that, you know, were to pull or want to give on the clevis, it's only going to cinch down on itself. And not have that chance of opening up. This is then going to be able to allow for us to switch out flies quicker and effectively, so we're not having to cut back on our leader material, or bite wire material, I should say, you know, after changing every fly.
Yeah, so that bite wire, does it come, is it just straight wire off a spool, or does it come with a loop already tied on it, or how's it, you know, pre-configured?
Sometimes it's going to be, most typically you're going to find it on a spool, like the Rio or American Fishing Wire. I think Toothy Critter actually comes in, you know, a sleeve or a baggie in that form. But nothing's actually tied. So, you know, as an angler, you could set this up at any length that you wanted to. But with the wire bite guard material, I typically will run it, you know, somewhere between 20, you know, 18 to 20 inches in length. But you're going to, you know, this is where knots are going to come down into being a fundamental part of this game. So, you know, whether it's a saltwater loop knot or a perfection loop, which would definitely be efficient for this type of fishing.
Okay. On to the leader, right?
Yep.
And then
yep.
What, kind
yeah,
of
so.
Knot, what kind of knot to the, I forget the name of the device you just told us about, but...
off the fluorocarbon to the, the fluorocarbon. So 40-pound fluorocarbon. So
right.
A lot of our fly lines do have like a loop, you know, loop-to-loop connection on the fly line that's built in. If you don't have that, take a chunk of your 40-pound fluorocarbon that you just got. I enjoy using the tie fast tool. It makes things really easy. I'll put that tie fast tool, and it's basically a nail knot onto my fly line. If there's no loop-to-loop connection on that fly line.
Right.
And then from there, I'll actually have about 6 inches, maybe 8 inches, and I'll create a perfection loop. That perfection loop will then go down and have, there'll be a butt section to where I can switch out leaders. And I'll stay on my fly line almost all season, depending on how beat up tethered it gets. And then from there, I'll start my 40-pound fluorocarbon and then into my bite wire using loop-to-loop connections.
From the bite wire to the fluorocarbon loop-to-loop
yep.
there as well?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And then what kind of knot do you use at the end there when you...
Loop-to-loop, you know, is you can use a perfection loop. At the end to go to, like, you know, to your clevis or, you know, then to your fly, or you could also use it like a saltwater loop knot. That would also be efficient in tying on with tieable wire. Yep.
Yeah, okay.
And all these things are basically just, you know, to keep in mind, you know, there's kind of a system that I'm, you know, it being able to switch out a leader and being able to, you know, keep that wire or switch out your wire or switch out a clevis. All these things are, you know, removable in a sense without having to cut up everything and retying a lot. So simply with these loop-to-loop connections and stuff like that, it makes things really easy and effective. Because the biggest thing is 10,000 casts, you want that fly in the water at all times as much as possible.
Yeah. And if you see any, you know, if you've had a fish or two on, you want to make sure that you're all, your bite wire and everything is intact and not nicked or whatever, I suppose. So.
Exactly, yeah. If, you know, if it's nicked or something, switch it out, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Now, do you worry about backing the muskie run on you, or do they, you know, when you get a big muskie on,
you know,
what's your expectation there?
You know, I mean, unless you're, say, in high waters, river situation where you have a fish that hits that current and decides to take off down river, you know, that might be the only time you'll ever put a fish on a reel, actually. So these fish are not, you know, drag screaming like, say, carp or saltwater game species. They fight hard. They'll whoop your butt up and down, but they do not, you know, you're able to fight them, you know, just as if you're fighting, you know, say, trout or bass, where you're actually stripping the line and, you know, with your finger using that as tension, so to say. So our reels, honestly, they're just holding the line. They're just holding, you know, backing is necessary just so then our line doesn't,
hold
on. You know,
yeah.
It's, you know, it doesn't free spool on our fly reel, but, you know, it's just there to hold the line, so. But, you know, it's always nice to having a decent reel, so then if you do decide to take it to salt water, you have that opportunity. So.
And, you know, what's the average length of your cast when you're casting for muskie?
You know, it can be a little bit depending on the angler. So, you know, we're casting these big lines. They're big rods. And then also with that, you know, bigger flies, you know, we put flies to be not too water weighted, not to be like throwing a wet sock all day. So we're efficient in that way, but, you know, that could be as far as 20 feet or it could be as much as 60 feet in a cast. Maybe, you know, the whole fly line if possible, you know, that's outstanding, but you don't need to be able to cast that far, you know, when you're angling. So we can set ourselves up to the best advantage with whatever your cast is and say, if you're able to cast effectively at this distance, we'll pull yourself off those weed beds or those rock piles and to be able to be hitting those properly and effectively. Or if you're floating down the river, setting up that boat, you know, just so off distance away from your structure. So,
do you is there any other equipment that you would recommend bringing out the boat with you or having with you that is specific?
Yeah.
Muskie fishing?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess with rod-wise, I cannot say enough about some of the loop rods. They are absolutely the Magnum 45 of casting big flies and having a lot of power. But as we go into some of our other tackle and, you know, tools that we're going to use, our nets are critical. We want to be able to safely handle these fish, keeping them in the water as much as possible. The other aspect is a jaw spreader. These fish have very, very strong jaws, so they're going to latch down and they might hold their mouth shut when you're trying to get your fly out of that fish's mouth. This will allow for, it's kind of a spring tension, so it'll allow for that fish to, you know, keep the fish's mouth open while you can remove the hook safely and without, you know, hurting or harming the fish or yourself. The other aspect, no doubt, is a long pair of needle nose pliers. And they can't be just like a little pair of hemostats. They got to be a good pair of needle nose, long handled, because these fish get large, they get big. You want to be able to access and get that hook out. And they got a very bony structured mouth. Last but not least, always have a hook with you at hand. If that fish were to take a hook extremely deep, and if you're not fishing barbless hooks, you know, I know some anglers won't. I prefer to choose to fish barbless hooks all the time. But if you choose not to, that's just fine, but have that hook cutter. Because if a fish does have that deeply swallowed or it's in their gills or something, you know, cut that hook and, you know, let that fish live on. Retire that fly and safely get that fish back to the water and swimming back to its true nature.
The, yeah, you know, I even caught a small pike once. And they were flopping around in my hands, and this wasn't fly fishing. This was just spin fishing. But he put one of the treble hooks, which was barbed, through the web between my thumb and my forefinger, right through that.
Oh, ouch.
My two young kids were in the boat with me and stuff, and so I'm out there with a Swiss Army knife trying to hack on my trying to get that out, you know, and so those pliers could come in handy too if you have to cut that hook so that you don't have to pull the barb out of your hand.
Exactly,
too.
And there's actually a really good trick for that. Now you have your wire that you're using for, you know, your bite guard and stuff like that. You can actually wrap that around the hook shank, you know, the curvature of the hook where it's, you know, entered into your hand or in your leg or arm or whatever, and you can push down on the eyelet. And as you push down on the eyelet, if you take your needle nose and you grab that wire and give it a swift pop, it will come out as you're pulling away. You can look this up online.
I've seen it.
It does work. It does work. I've been there. It's been a hook stuck in me. It works. No fun, but... That's why we'll, you know, try to debarb those hooks. It makes it easier on the angler than if, you know, it happens.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back. We'll talk about flies, because I know that's a big subject for you. Like you said, you have to buy a lot of yourself, so we'll talk about that in just a moment. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. They have an option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view their fishing products and guide services they offer in both Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Eric Tuohy about Muskie Magic. If you'd like to ask Eric a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as we can tonight on the show. And here's a question that we can use to start off our fly section here. Off the internet, Barry Coddins in Grays Lake, Illinois. He says, there are very few tying videos for tying musky flies online, I guess is what he meant to say.
Okay.
Do you post any such videos for flies you tie?
I guess I do have a topwater fly that I use that's it's actually a single hook musky fly, and then the topwater portion of the head is actually on a tube fly and has some rubber legs and such. It's actually titled the Chugger Knot. It's caught some extremely large fish in this area throughout other areas for musky, but that is out there. There are some other available videos out there. My suggestion would be looking up Blaine Shockett has some outstanding patterns that he's designed and innovative. Some great materials with that.
What was the name again?
Blaine Shockett. He's a guide out of West Virginia. He has some unique flex tubing that he utilizes in his flies. He also has some great shanks. They're also made by the Flyman Company, which is, you know, if you're familiar with like fish skulls and all that you can add to your flies. He has some great videos that are out there.
You're saying it kind of fast, and I'm not catching it.
Blaine Shockett?
No, Gwayne? Wayne?
Blaine, yep, B-L-A-N-E.
Oh, Blaine.
Shockett. Yep. Blaine. So he has a T-bone,
And how, T-bone fly. Slow down, man.
Okay.
Blaine, how do you spell his last name so people can look this up?
C-H-O. I'm trying to remember here. C H O C K L.
Chocolate. Plain chocolate.
Yes.
I see up here. B L A N E. then Chalk, and then LTT.
Yep. So a music guide out of Virginia,
Okay.
And he has a fly pattern called the T-bone in particular.
I see it right there. It says there's a YouTube video showing it, part one of three.
Yeah.
So.
There you go. I mean, right there, you know, Brad Bone of Musky Country, there's a, if you do a little sifting, do some Google searches, it's out there, it's available. There's plenty of videos for, it's outstanding, this, the modern day and age, and being able to learn, and they're out there, do a little searching though.
Yeah, yeah, it is much better today, like when I started as a kid, how we had black and white fuzzy photos to look at.
Exactly.
Trying to figure out how to tie something.
Yep.
You didn't
have somebody show
you. It was hard, you know?
Oh, yeah. I do my thread wraps, I guess, backwards, so to say. But, you know, I never had, you know, I was in the same boat. I had, you know, what the little book offered as a kit, you know, to be able to be like, oh, okay, well, you actually wrap forward, but I wrap backwards. You know, I wrap towards me.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. Okay. So, primary food source for muskie is what?
Oh, man. So,
anything that moves?
You know, I mean, almost. I mean, I won't say just about anything that moves. You know, I do have to give them more respect to that, but they will eat baby ducks. They'll eat, you know, full-size ducks, and they'll eat muskrats. They'll eat basically every other fish. They'll eat their own other muskies. They are the top dogs, so they are the apex predators. So their body and everything, you know, from their back tail fins all the way up, and how their head and everything shaped is, you know, they're built for speed. They're built to be able to eat, and they have some teeth that, you know, you really don't want to tangle with. And there, you know, there's a reason for that. So when we're thinking about that in correlation with our fly patterns. If the lake, say, has a predominant large population of crappies, you know, we can start utilizing that match to the hatch theory. Or if it's perch, maybe, you know, some parts of northern Minnesota, a few areas of Wisconsin also, we have a Cisco, you know, population in certain bodies of water. And, you know, that gives us unique opportunities then in the fall to be able to, you know, throw these large Cisco patterns. And so, it's a little bit of, do a little bit of research, find out, you know, what some of these other game fish are, and, you know, match that hatch in that sense. I also think, though, that contrasting colors can work as well on that end, too.
Okay, we just got a question in on the Internet from Stephen in Perryville, Kentucky.
Okay.
He's talking about color. He says, is there one color to use when tying musky flies that musky seem to be attracted to more than others? Or what color do you seem to catch most of your muskies on?
Oh, man, that's wild. That's an interesting question because, you know, for me, it definitely varies from body of water, time of the day, or maybe sometimes it's how I might feel. I do have some go-to colors that, for me, like a yellow and green, I call it the Lambo colors, Packer colors. But anyways, that's been actually a really good color for me. Some of the natural, so, you know, whether it's kind of like a lightish, light tan, maybe with some white going up to, like, say, a darker brown, maybe even, like, some black in there. That's definitely, you know, kind of touching base a little bit with that sucker-type-looking fly. You know, the traditional black and orange is kind of, in my opinion, one of the tried and true colors, even through the gear world, that probably just about anywhere would work. And you can't go wrong with white. And there's so much that dictates from water clarity to what our sunlight is doing that might make me choose to go to a certain direction in water or in fly selection and color.
A lot of fly fishers will lean towards the dark colors for, you know, dark water or cloudy water or, you know, dusk fishing. Do you do the same thing, same principles apply, dark for dark and light for light kind of thing?
Yeah, for the most part. And sometimes, I mean, you know, your dark water, you know, we have some tannic water up here. I mean, I'll put on a white fly. I'm not too worried about that because, you know, these flies are built to move water, and so they're still able to hone in on that, I feel.
Okay, yeah, they feel the, their lateral line or whatever, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, is there a, you know, in trout fishing we always have a few go-to flies. Do you have a go-to fly that you always fall back on?
Yeah, I mean, the single-hooked fly platform is definitely a good benchmark for that. It's not too difficult to cast, and you can. But for me, the doubles, so you know, a fly that is in tandem, so whether there's two hooks or a hook and a shank, I would say that kind of a yellow with some chartreuse and going up to like that brown, maybe with a little bit of black in there. Like I said, is that transitional color for me? I don't know. It looks good in the water. I guess it's been definitely a go-to color for me for the past few years. But, you know, like I said, I will hop around a little bit.
Does that have a name? You're talking about colors, but is there a name,
colors,
a pattern? Or?
You know, I guess there's a couple, you know, that I guess I have a little bit slightly unnamed, which is, I hate to say, but, you know, there are definitely some of these, you know, where I might borrow, like, the T-bone pattern, and I'll utilize some of those tying techniques. And then I'll put in my personal, say, artisan twist to it.
So, you know, where would one start? If you've never tied a musky fly, then, you know, where do you start? I mean, is some pattern somewhere?
Yeah. You know, I think looking up like the original reverse tied bucktail, that is definitely used, you know, in the gear world for making bucktails. But reverse tying bucktail, it was kind of used for like squid type patterns, and then it was brought into definitely the musky game. And what that is doing is that you're creating a big cone profile. You're able to use not a ton of materials, but still be able to give you that file and have something that is going to swim. And I mean swim as that fly is moving left to right, just like we see some of our big gear musky baits. Very critical. And so that would be reverse tying bucktail. Learn that art form. Learn how to really utilize bucktail. Bucktail is such a unique material. You know, it's hollow, it's dense, and it's airy, and then you hand select your materials. You can really get some quality materials out there that, you know, long and short and however you prefer to tie. So that'd be where I'd start as a good platform hook, 2-aught, Gamakatsu, B10S hook. They're strong. It's a good platform to tie on, and then good, strong thread.
Okay.
Yep.
Are there any kind of common design problems you've seen with large flies that you
I think, you know, the biggest thing would be keeping a size profile, because come fall, you know, we want to be able to throw our biggest fly that we possibly can throw. You know, these fish are feeding, maybe they have a small feeding window, say mid to late November, at least in our neck of the woods, when the water temps or the lakes have turned over. They're feeding on a 4-pound walleye, and they're only eating once a day. So you start looking at those logistics, you want to be throwing the biggest fly out that you can throw. So keeping the fly with less water weight, the biggest thing, and being able to keep it lightweight enough to cast it, and then also still being able to have something that really does swim and when we get it wet. So
you mentioned bucktail a lot. Are there other materials you like to work with that are lighter weight or less water?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of great, I mean, even synthetic, you know, nature's guard hairs are awesome. They're there for a reason, you know, to help protect that animal, to keep them warm. But likewise, there's also these synthetics that are outstanding that have their advantages that shed water easier. So there's, you know, yak hair, There's some other similar hair that Misfit Fly Company puts out there, very similar to that yak hair. There's also some EP fibers that are out there that are outstanding. You get some great length and movement, and we can intertwine and utilize all these things and mesh them with our natural materials as well and create these non-water weighted flies that really do swim.
Mm-hmm. Dan Limbarger in Illinois asks,
mm-hmm.
are there specific dry patterns you recommend for most locations? Is marabou a good choice for tying streamers for muskie? Two-part
so
question,
I guess,
there.
Okay, so dry patterns, so like topwater stuff.
Right.
You know, going on to the topwater thing, I had mentioned earlier a fly pattern that I use called the chugger knot. You know, this is on a tube fly. So a single hook musky fly and then this tube fly that's on there. This tube fly allows for a lot of number of things. So we actually get a larger profile as a topwater fly. We're also then getting this really unique kind of movement and not just a straight lining pop. And we're pushing a lot of big water. These are big popper heads. I'm talking, you know, roughly just under an inch in diameter coned heads. And so then from there, we're also having higher hooking percentages. So we'll still fish a popper head that's, you know, glued and attached to a single hook. But we do have to be really conscious of our gap that we have in between the foam and the actual hook point. And then, you know, there's also a little bit that we have to work, you know, just be considerate about anchoring points where that fish, the teeth could, you know, really grip into that foam. And you might not be able to turn or allow for that fly to actually roll and get a hook set in the corner of its mouth. So that's where a two-fly, the chugger knot, comes in handy. I mean, 9 times out of 10, very high hooking percentages. Kind of
chugger. It was chugger, not.
Not. Yep.
Like astronaut, only chugger not.
Exactly. And you can, like I said, I did a little snippet video on YouTube on it, kind of a little bit of a variation of that. If you do look me up on Instagram, I do post a lot of, you know, what I'm doing with my fly tying. You know, I'm making a lot of popper heads lately, and definitely a lot of fun.
Yeah, I see it. Here's the first one that came up there. Chuggernaut musky fly on YouTube. Yeah. So there you go, folks. You want to dig in and check that one out. Okay, good. Let's talk about some strategies and presentation. Rob Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, wrote in. Says, I've heard it takes 1,000 or 10,000 casts to catch a muskie. Any advice for a novice? And then Dan from North Dakota, similar, he says, I spend time in the summer on a prime Minnesota muskie lake. Every year I see fly fishermen flailing their arms off trying to catch the fish of 10,000 casts. How are we to do better with a fly rod? I don't think I have 10,000 casts in me.
Well,
so both,
you know,
those questions, you know, that's always the, why is it so hard to catch a muskie?
Yeah, no doubt. Those are great questions, and thanks to Rob and Dan for putting those out there. So fish of 10,000 casts. You know, there's, I guess, advice from my standpoint would be is really to, you know, if we start looking at time of the year and weather patterns, we can look at our moon phases. So if we have a big storm front coming through, I want to be on the water because there are things that are happening that are triggering fish to eat. So fishing before big fronts like that. Moon phases are a huge part in playing on how some muskies feed. If we have a full moon, there's feeding window opportunities that are crazy. I mean, where you could see multiple big fish within a one-hour period of the day, and that's it. But it's hot and heavy, and it's on, and you better be ready. So moon phases, so full moon, new moon. We also might look at our moon calendar, and we might look and see, well, when is the moon underfoot, you know, under our feet? What time is that at? And it could, these fish might turn on an hour before that or an hour after or right on the nose, sunrise, sunset. there's also sometimes there. Other advice is just being on the water. I've had circumstances where high noon sun, not a breeze to save your life, and it's just, I mean, and you have two fish go within 20 minutes apart and one that's pushing over 40 inches. And I can't say scientifically why did that these two fish actively eat, you know, and it's just being on the water.
Are there actually less musky than pike, numbers-wise?
That's kind of an interesting question. There's some bodies of water, even up here, that don't have northern pike part of the ecosystem or very low numbers of it, or never used to have them, and now they have a small amount of them in the body of water. I guess
I'm thinking more about like territorial, you know, like is there one muskie for every 100 square feet? Compared to pike that are more tightly, you know, engaged.
Sure.
I don't know.
And actually, that's, you know, a lot of anglers used to think that, the muskie is very territorial and they're gonna cover a whole zone, so to say. That's not true. I've worked a 100-yard stretch in seven different fish that are 45-plus inches, and that's some pretty tight quarters when you're talking about a fish that size and the meals that they're eating. And they're just basically, they're following their instincts to follow where the – and so there's no reason that other fish, big and small, are going to school up, so to say, and be in an area, whether it's a weed bed or a shoreline break edge or a reef or hump, any type of structure like that, but – kind of the 10,000 cast, though, like Dan had mentioned, it's the gear. It's interesting because they can be efficient and, you know, with these high capacity reels that take in a lot of line very quickly and effectively. But if you think about a fish that's 5, 10, 15, 20 years old, how many times have they seen some of these old baits cross over the top of their head? They really haven't seen these flies. You know, this is something that's still useful as a sport, but not only, like, these fish are really not seeing this stuff on a day-to-day basis. And then I also think really how flies do swim and, you know, how we fish is so unique that I really think these fish, I'm more confident in having a fly rod at hand than having a bait caster and bucktail, by far.
Yeah. When you talk about time of year, the muskie are, they're moving in and out, right, from deeper water to shallower water and back and forth throughout the season kind of thing. So where do you find you get your most action? At what point in that movement, you know, at what depth? Is there a kind of a hot spot depth in the water column that you find you get more fish out?
Sure. They are definitely, you know, variables that come into play with time of the year and where these fish are going to be located. Earlier in the year, they're coming off from spawning. You know, we can't fish for spawning fish. They do open at a specific time, and then our season does close eventually. But so they come out of spawn, and then from there, they hold fairly close to these spawning grounds, and then they hit these other transitions. But personally, as the time of the year goes on, you know, summer is great because we have established weed beds. Many of our lakes have cabbage as a primary, you know, weed growth and some of the other types of longleaf type weeds. But when those are established, though, those are a lot of fun, tons of fun fishing-wise, because you can have fish that are on top of the weeds. You have fish that are kind of off the edges, and sometimes they're off way completely off the weed bed edge in deeper water. That's a unique time of the year. And then also, well, my favorite is the fall time of the year when you're going to have the highest percentage of bigger fish. You know, the biggest fish are eating that time of the year. So whether that's, and it always dictates on how our year comes around, but sometimes it's early to mid-September. If we have a warmer September, that time of the year can be slightly slower, and then as things transition, it gets better mid-September into late. If we have an earlier fall, though, it can get going as soon as early September and well into October, no doubt.
Do you fish muskie differently in rivers than you do in lakes?
Oh, absolutely. You know, with fishing the rivers, you know, you're floating, you're going to pick out a place to launch of choice and then, you know, where you plan to pull out. So, typically a secondary vehicle or a bicycle or some form of mode of transportation to be able to pick up, you know, where you're pulling out is, you have to put that into play. Whereas the lake, we don't have to worry about that. We can drop a boat in, we could pull it out and go hit a different lake and all in the same day if we wanted to. With that also being said, you know, we're floating a river, so you're covering a lot of, you know, you might cover, say, 8 miles in a day, maybe a little bit more. You know, now you put that into a sense of what you're hitting specifically for structure on a river, you know, and you put it into, say, 300-400 acre lake, maybe bigger. I mean, we can vary up our shots pretty drastically in a day lake. So there's definitely some differences. And if we move a hot fish on a river and, you know, out of a big pool with an eddy or something, and that fish is almost like just ready to eat, but kind of comes up and falls and veers off at the last second, you know, in a lake circumstance, we could come back to that fish. We might come back to that fish when we have a moonrise or moon underfoot or, say, a sunrise or sunset, whatever that might be, picking out these advantages to feeding up, you know, windows. And that's where it comes into play a little bit differently on lakes and rivers.
Yeah, Lisa in Illinois, Iowa, Illinois, I guess she goes back and forth, or lives on the border.
Yeah.
says, I know your emphasis has most recently been stillwater fly fishing for muskie. Do you feel there are any good stillwater watery environments that frequently get overlooked when anglers target muskie? So, do you get that question?
I guess, you know, I think as
looking
as
for
fly
frequently
fishing,
overlooked fisheries, it sounds like.
So. Yeah. Okay. So I guess, I mean, I think there's in our area there's a lot of overlooked lakes, no doubt, because there are some waters that actually aren't labeled. They might have interconnections with other waterways that may carry muskies, so therefore it might have muskies. But even for down there, you know, I think even just fly anglers in general, you know, we are so drawn to rivers, which is, I mean, they're beautiful. They're great, and you're seeing a lot of cool country, and, you know, there's nothing like taking a good float down the river. But, you know, you can get on the wild lakes, and you're not being pressured, and, you know, other than, you know, some gear anglers, and like I said, these fish are not seeing this stuff on a day-to-day basis, so.
Well, you make it, you offer some hope there, Eric.
Yep, yep.
They might like a fly better than, those segmented lures that, I remember my uncles and from the Chicago area going up every year for muskie fishing in Wisconsin, so. I think, you know, I would think there's probably very few lakes that have muskie in them that people don't know about. people have been fishing for them for so many years. In fact, one of my uncles, they used to call him Muskie.
Nice.
He was always after that trophy fish and could never seem to get one.
Okay.
but he went every year. So they called him Muskie.
Nice.
So, are you just randomly casting out there into these structure areas or so forth, or do you do any sight fishing for muskie?
Yeah, so there's a little bit of each, I guess, say. I mean, so we're going to work an area of structure, and sometimes this might be really deep, you know, when our late fall, like I was talking about earlier, these fish might be, you know, in 14 feet of water, close to shallow breaks, but also close to deeper water, where there's transition lines, like from weeds to rocks, or, you know, weeds to sand, and other different variations that are out there. But, so sometimes, yeah, we're fishing deep, and we're also a little bit blind casting. I mean, we're trying to think of being efficient in our cast, and so casting well, but then also, you know, I'm going to cast here, and then I'm already, you know, I'm going to hit this zone for my next cast. During certain times of the year, yes, we do have fishing, sight fishing opportunities. It's definitely not something that we can say, oh, from this time of the year to this time of the year, our fish are in the shallows constantly, and that, you know, we're even push-pulling for them in that sense. It's a little bit of a luck of the draw where we might pull up, and this would be more earlier in the season, where, you know, early summer too, that these fish will push up into the shallows, say like sand flats or up by rocks, because, you know, that area warms up and they might be sleeping. They might have just had their, you know, full meal that morning, and they're utilizing those warmer temperatures just to help digest. And sometimes they're up there hunting. If the sunfish and crappies or bass are up in the shallows spawning or something like that, you know, they're going to be where their food source is to hunt. So there are some opportunities to sight fish, there's no doubt, and sometimes it happens. Sometimes, you know, it would take a little bit more searching to try and accomplish.
So you don't really do much sight fishing, I take it. I mean, it's probably hard to, at the depth.
Unless
they're in the shallows, is that the...
You know, when we're fishing shallower water for the earlier part of the time of the year, and then a little bit in the later time of the year, you know, you could see fish up shallow, but we're not specifically going up to try to specifically sight fish.
Okay.
You know, yeah.
Blind casting then. Yeah, okay.
A little bit, yeah.
Any techniques you use to, you know, get a strike, stripping, you know, what recommendations
Can
you give to folks on that?
Yeah. Well, there's definitely that goes, you know, a lot that goes into that. Strip set is 100%. You can't do really anything else. These fish, you know, they're very strong jaw structures. So that strip set, the saltwater strip set, that is going to give you the best hookup possibilities. Keeping sharp hooks, you know, definitely having a good sharp hook is key to that as well. But if a fish misses and doesn't feel any hooks or isn't spooked off by, you know, whatever, that fish has an opportunity to turn around and eat again, versus if you raise that rod in any way off to the side or up high, you know, you're going to have a good chance of pulling that fly well out of any strike zone. The other aspect that is very key to when we actually have the ability to get hookups is I like to think of every cast broken up into the rule of thirds. So the first few strips on the initial cast and retrieve is actually, if you're close into a fish and in their zone and that fish is ready to eat, you know, be ready, because that's when it could happen. If you come over the top of a fish's head mid-strip, so to say, in between, you know, the length of your cast, midway, you know, you could have a fish eat there. But the last third remaining is that we always actually bring our rod down into the water. We do a figure eight. You're going to see gear guys do this. You can look it up. There's some videos a little bit on fly guys doing this and showing about it, but you can also learn this from gear as well. So we create a figure eight in the water with our rod tip, and we bring the fly down deep in the water column. We might bring it up higher in the water column on our outside turns, and then as we proceed on our straightaways of an eight, we're actually going down deep again. And by doing this, we're actually bringing the fly up and away from the boat. And what that's doing is it's creating the fish to be able to see the fly at a different angle. It's changing the speed of the fly. And it's also, you know, it's triggering the instinct in that fish to eat. So, you know, about a third of our eats are actually right at our feet, right in front of you. Very, very, very visual strikes, and it's very aggressive eat. So always being ready, and, you know, you can figure eight, you can do a circle, or you can do something called a J-turn, which is simply just create, you know, painting a J with the rod. And we always have to be watching behind that fly.
Sorry, I had to cough there.
Oh,
yeah, and then, you know, I can attest to that figure eight. I remember the first time one of my uncles told me to do that, and we were gear fishing at the time. And he says, "And you have to have known this uncle. He was just a prankster to no end." and so he says, "Yeah, go ahead. You know, when you get to the end, do this figure eight." And I figure it's like, you know, catching snipe or something like that. You know, something crazy that he's pulling on me. So I do this figure eight, you know, and I did it a couple times, and then about three casts later, I do that figure eight, and just wham, you know, about a 48-inch fish tried to take it, like 2 feet from the boat, you know, I couldn't believe it that they were taking it that closely. I didn't hook up with them, but it scared the hell out of me. You know?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
it's amazing, you know. So.
Yeah.
They're not afraid of the boat, evidently.
Yeah. no. They'll sit under it. I mean, you could have a fish that, you know, in a lake or a river that will lay super low, and say if you're in darker water and you never actually see it visually, or that fish, you know, basically sits under your boat and you come in to do your figure eight and that fish came out of nowhere. I mean, it's crazy. And these are the things that, you know, really wreck you in this sport. I mean, they'll shake up your world. You'll lose sleep over it. And, I mean, I'm only warning you.
Yeah, the one that got away, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Paul, Paul in Roanoke, Virginia, is kind of a follow-up on this. He says, "I've had fish come in hot and then just fall off at the boat's side. What little tricks do you have?" So I guess you've kind of answered this, Jay, in a circle and so forth.
Yep.
So the other thing that I'd noticed with pike, because I haven't fished for muskie that much on a fly, but with pike, I can see them coming in. I mean, you can see them in clear water coming in and following that that fly or lure, and they'll get about, you know, two-thirds of the way in and then turn off, you know.
Yeah.
So when you see something coming in and you can see that fish following it, what do you do differently to try to get them to take when it's further out? You know, it's not next to the boat.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so if I'm seeing a fish following, and you could have a fish, I mean, literally they're back out of the water with a giant V wake. I mean, it's like an alligator. It's scary almost. You know, with my clients, you know, or even myself, you know, I'm gonna be telling that person to constantly be stripping if that fish is extremely hot and heavy. So don't really slow down that retrieve. Keep it constant. Keep that fly swimming all the way up to the boat and keep it fluent into your figure eights. And we don't have to get too aggressive with our figure eights. You know, sometimes it happens naturally, but, you know, keeping it really a good flow to it because we don't want to spook that fish. The next thing, too, is if that fish is maybe moving a little bit slower to it, trying to continue that same retrieve. So maybe if there's a pause or two with a couple extra twitches in there, that can at least keep that fish interested and not dropping off too soon. If you really are having fish that are, I mean, honestly just coming in like power trains right behind it and then dropping off at the boat, there could be a variable that fish saw the boat, saw you, and dipped out. That fish might just actually drop down and try, and is actually still hunting the fly and looking at another angle for trying to eat that fly. So figure eight for a minute, you know, see what happens. That fish might show herself again and flash and flare. So, you know, it's not unheard of guys figure eighting for, or girls figure eighting, two, 3 minutes, you know, I mean, it could happen. So the biggest thing is keeping that fly in the water. The next thing that you can do is if you can stay spot locked where that fish moves, you could then say have another rod set up and or switch your fly out really quickly. Say it's a different type of fly. Say it's a topwater fly. Say it's a completely different coloration. But we could throw that back out there, vary our retrieve, completely opposite or the same, and just do something different. And that we call that a throwback. So we can give them a throwback, something as another option, give them another opportunity, and try to entice a strike.
Good. Yeah. Well, that's good. We'll have to end with that. And we're running out of time here, so we have to kind of wrap things up.
Oh.
But that's a good good way to end it, how to get those extra strikes. from those follow-ups, because it sure gets exciting. It's, you know, when you see the fish coming in, it's like,
oh yeah,
take it.
Oh yeah.
And it's a little bit, you know, different than trout fishing and stuff, where, you know, trout will not move very much to take, you know, expend much energy, but those big fish will move a lot, you know, to take a lure or fly.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, listen, hang in here with me, Eric, because we're going to do a few giveaway of prizes and stuff, and I ask a question of the live audience that I'm going to have you help me make sure we get the right answer to. So, folks, we're going to be right back, but we're going to give away, and we're going to give away 1 year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, 1 year subscription to Fly Fishing and Dying Journal, and then also that $25 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers, which you can redeem either in their shop in Boulder, Colorado, or in their online store as well. So stick with us here just another couple minutes. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.familyties.com. That's family and then T-Y-E-S.com. Family, T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners of the drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. If you didn't register yet for tonight's show, it's too late, but next time, make sure you register for the next show and you have a chance to win some of these great prizes we have. If you are one of the lucky winners, then we're going to contact you after the show and get your information so that we can send out your prize to you. So the first thing we're going to give away is a 1 year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And the Federation is a great organization to support. Doesn't matter if you're fishing for muskie, permit, or trout. They cover all the different kinds of waters. They're all conservation-oriented, so it's a good place to be part of. And you can go to their website at fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. So check them out and become a member of the Federation of Fly Fishers. Okay, let's get a winner for that, and that's, let's see here. Dale Bear in Montana. So Dale Bear in Montana. So congrats, Dale. Let me just write this down quick so I don't lose it. So there's our winner for the 1 year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And our next winner is going to be for this Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, courtesy of Amato Books. Check Amato Books out, AmatoBooks.com. Lots of fly fishing books and periodicals as well that'll get your juices going here. So let's see who our winner there is. Come on, computer. Come on. Hold on. So I guess I didn't feed the mice enough. Oh, there we go. Okay. Thomas T-Cat. Cax, Thomas, I'm going to destroy your name, in Georgia. So Thomas, T-K-A-C-S, congratulations on that. You got a subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So I hope you're a tier. If not, you can learn to be by going through that journal, that's for sure. And now we're going to have a giveaway this $25 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers. And the way we do this is I ask a question, and you can answer the question on the homepage of our website in that where you can ask questions during the show, that box. Put in your answer, your name, and your location in there, and the first person to answer it will win this $25 gift certificate. Like I said, you can redeem it online or in the store in Boulder if you happen to be out Colorado way. So, the question is, Eric had mentioned his bike guard. What's the length of his bike guard? Bike guard. It's, he gave it a range from what to what is his normal length of his bike guard. So let's see if we get somebody to bite on that.
Right?
I know. It wasn't that funny. But.
It was good. I was waiting for the poonch.
Oh, okay. So the first one in, I think he's got it here. 8 to 20 inches, right, Eric?
It was that. I mean, that's close. He had it at 20 inches. It maybe sounded like
18 to 20 inches.
Oh,
he said.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's Jake Jones in Yukon, Oklahoma. So, Jake, congratulations.
Awesome. Congrats, Jake.
Glad you won that, and Jake, you'll have to send me. And you can send it through the same way you just sent your answer in. Send me your email address. I got everything I need here, Jake, because that's all of they'll email you the certificate, and you're good to go. So I got everything I need. You don't need to do anything. So just congratulations. Enjoy that. See if you can. There's always something to buy in a fly shop, right? So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You can always spend $25 somewhere. So congratulations, guys, and thanks for playing, and thanks for listening to the show. So, Eric, I really appreciate you being on with us, and it's a pleasure to talk with you and talk about
Yeah, thanks
lesson.
For having me. Absolutely, yeah.
It was
outstanding.
Yeah, glad you could join us and take time out. And maybe we'll see you next year in Colorado at one of the shows. So I'm glad that
Absolutely.
Worked out for you. Yeah. Hopefully you've all found the archive on our website. If you haven't, there are a couple of links to it on our homepage. At the bottom of every page on the website, you'll find our past shows, over 220 shows now. So that's quite the library of fly fishing information. So go in there, search around. You know, you can search for muskie, you can search for trout. Try muskie both ways. I found out there's both of them. Both spellings are correct, basically, it seems. And, you know, you can search for a body of water, that kind of thing. And go out there and learn. Great, great people that we've had on our show. So explore that and check it out. Our next broadcast is going to be on April 6th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. Hold on. Getting over a cold here. I'm going to mute out every time I cough. On that show, I'll be interviewing Jay Zimmerman. And our topic for the show will be carp flies, how to tie and fish them. So Jay's a professional guide and fly tying instructor. And he's been chasing carp since he was a kid. Carp are a finicky bunch. If you've ever tried to fish for them, they need special attention. So Jay is going to share with us his best flies for carp and how to tie and fish them. So join us for that show. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River and Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. And before you leave, don't forget to sign in on our homepage for the announcement so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. Hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone.